Welcome. This is Stan Lee of Marvel Comics warning you to look around you, your classmates, your friends. You never know which one of them may be a mutant.
This is Xavier's Podcast for Gifted Youngsters, Episode 4, the bi-weekly podcast following the complete history of the X-Men issue by issue. This time around, Michael Bailey and J. David Weider look at X-Men number 3, wherein our mutant heroes face the menace of the Blob, and the circus invades Xavier's mansion.
Everybody, and welcome back to Xavier's Podcast for Gifted Youngsters, an X-Men podcast presented by not the X-Men homepage.
No.
Which proves that I am so used to doing a certain type of intro that I can't break the habit. My name is Michael Bailey.
And I am J. David Weider.
And we are back once again to discuss an issue in the life of the soon-to-be Uncanny X-Men, going all the way back to 1963. And if the podcasting deities see fit to have us continue doing this, we'll go through everything through the 60s. We'll have the best X-Men hits from the 60s, the 70s, the 80s, and today.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, maybe not today.
Well, yeah, and I don't even know why I turned into Kool-Aid Man on that one.
Oh, yeah! It's the best character ever created. He's a man composed of Kool-Aid and glass who breaks through brick walls.
Enjoy the physics on that. Well, it's ironic we bring up the Kool-Aid Man in this particular issue, episode. Considering who we're...
That should be the Blob's new catchphrase. Oh, yeah! Alrighty, sir. It's your turn to tell us what happened in the book we are covering this week. I believe they call that a synopsis.
Synopses is the plural, as I found out recently.
Synopses. Yeah. Synopsis. It's nemesis.
Yeah, this week, this time around, we're covering X-Men number 3, which is cover dated January 1964. But actually went on sale November 5th, 1963, because nothing important happened in 1963, specifically November. It was written by Stan Lee, penciled by Jack Kirby, inked by Paul Reinman, lettered by Artie Simek. Of course, Stan Lee was also the editor. The cover was done by Jack Kirby and Saul Brodsky. Speaking of the cover, it's cast against a white background again. And in this, the Blob...
Nothing moves the Blob!
Shirtless Behemoth takes on the full team of our merry mutants. Cyclops Cyclops blasts the large man with his optic beams. Iceman hurls an ice missile. The Angel tries with no success to lift the great big man off the ground. And Beast attempts to perform a roll kick while Marvel Girl gets dragged around by the wrist. And the blurb reads, X-Men battle one of the strangest super foes of all time. The newest Lee Kirby spectacular... Beware the Blob. 24 pages of thrills. So let's crack open that cover and read about the X-Men, the teenage superheroes who have taken America by storm. And we join the X-Men in Xavier's mansion, where a training session is already in progress. Cyclops is blasting away with his powerful optic blasts. That's also redundant. He's blasting at sawdust-filled practice bags being shot at him from a cannon-like machine operated by the Beast. The professor congratulates Cyclops, as his reaction time has sped up by 3% since the week before. And the Angel busies himself with catching the ricocheting bags, while Iceman simply freezes them in midair. And Professor X tells Scott that he's the most powerful of the X-Men, but he's always so grim and unsmiling. And Cyclops explains that he worries about the amount of pure, raw power in his eyes, and what could happen if he forgets to shield them. And sometimes he wishes he wasn't Cyclops at all. Marvel Girl snaps at him that she never wants to hear him say that again, while Iceman calls out that he's glad to have his powers and rips open one of the sawdust bags, which spills on the Beast. And the Beast reminds Iceman that he's allergic to sawdust and that Iceman is a feather-brained fathead, and if Beast didn't abhor violence... Before Beast can finish his sentence, the Angel flings one of the bags at Iceman, who responds by icing up the Angel's wings... Again, And Cyclops, while melting the ice, tells Warren that he talks a big talk, but he can't thaw Iceman's ice trap without his help. And the professor snaps all of the X-Men back to attention with his booming mental command, "Free time is over. The training period will continue." This time around, it's Jean's turn to test, with a challenge to her dexterity, beginning with holding a wooden block in the air through her telekinesis, and then mentally guiding it through multiple metal shapes. The professor praises Jean for being able to perform the task in 7 seconds, but then tells the class to silence themselves as he detects the presence of another mutant and must have all of his concentration to pinpoint the mystery mutant. Iceman, apparently missing the professor's order for silence, asks if the X-Men are going to go get the mutant. That's a lot of mutant. Sorry about that. Beast reminds Iceman that the mutant may not be male, while the Angel hopes out loud that it's another female like Marvel Girl. The professor orders the team to change into street clothes. As Angel is placing his harness on his wings, which we know probably wouldn't work in real life, and he's pulling on his civvies, the Beast enters the dorm room, fully dressed, and tells Warren that the first one to report to the professor gets to escort Jean. This leads to an out-and-out race between Bobby and Hank to report, while Cyclops mopes in the corner, thinking to himself that Jean's the only girl he would give his heart to, but he does not dare do so, not while he possesses this dread power. In Professor X's chamber, the prof warns Jean to be careful, as they do not know what powers this mutant possesses, and he might be a danger for her. Jean tells the professor that he's trained them well and he does not need to worry, but internally the professor thinks to himself, how can he not worry about the one that he loves? But he has no right to tell her, as long as he is the leader of the X-Men and confined to a wheelchair. Unaware of the professor's strange feelings, Jean grabs Scott by the arm and tells him not to be so grim, and that they will go look for the mutant together, much to Iceman's chagrin. Warren changes the plans by sweeping Jean off of her feet and whisking her out to the car, where they drive off. The three remaining X-Men go off to seek out this mystery mutant, and Bobby is excited as he thinks he's spotted the target right out of the gate when he comes across a man seemingly projecting fire from his hand. It turns out that the man is simply using a magnifying glass to burn paper, but he isn't the only one fooled. Hank spots a man floating in midair and ambles up the side of a building to greet his fellow mutant. But this, too, is a red herring, as the man is simply standing on a transparent glass shield for an advertising display. Scott, meanwhile, searches the carnival nearby. The professor advises him that the mutant must be near as the mental emanations are growing stronger. After first suspecting what looks like a sharpshooter taking out targets without looking, it turns out to be a fraud as another shooter is hiding under a table taking them out. Melting the second shooter's gun barrel, Scott then hears the carnival barker call out that the Blob is about to perform. Scott knows this large man is the one they seek, and the professor confirms it. Scott watches the Blob's show, which includes several men trying and failing to move the man, and then the Blob gets shot with a live gun, only to have the bullets harmlessly stick to his skin and then bounce back. After the show, Scott visits the Blob and takes a heavy-handed approach to getting him back to the X-Mansion. The Blob has heard of the X-Men, but refers to them as jerky juveniles in corny costumes, for you fans of alliteration. Warren and Jean show up and take a gentler approach, as opposed to Scott's "the X-Men don't take no for an answer" version. Seeing Jean piques the Blob's interest, and Scott decides to teach him some manners with his optic blasts, which knock the Blob into a hot stove. The Blob recovers and proves that nothing can hurt him by dousing the flame of a burning piece of wood with his bare hands. Having met Jean, the Blob agrees to go back to the X-Mansion. At the mansion, the Blob displays his powers, which is the inability to be moved once he places himself in a single spot. The Blob's flesh molecules seem to react to his mental command, which sounds incredibly gross. Blob flippantly tells the professor that, in plain English, he's pretty terrific. He's pretty cocky, which leads Bobby to believe that the Blob needs to be taken down a few notches. Bobby and the Blob have a verbal sparring match, which leads to Iceman forming a thick block of ice over the Blob's foot, which Blob easily breaks by wiggling his toe, much to Bobby's surprise. The professor is convinced to offer the Blob a spot on the X-Men, which Blob refuses, and basically because he does not want to be bossed around. The professor calls the X-Men to action. Now that the Blob knows their secret identities, he cannot be allowed to leave. Angel tries to stop Blob, only to be tossed right into Cyclops. And enraged, the Blob goes for Professor X, but Jean pushes their leader out of the way and slams the door to the mansion shut before the Beast makes a charge at the Blob, only succeeding in knocking him out the front door, which allows the Blob to get away. As the team recovers, the Professor explains that he's made his first serious mistake in bringing the Blob into the mansion. Jean asks the Professor if he can drive the memory from Blob's mind, and the Professor says that he can, but not from a long distance. The X-Men must retrieve the Blob, instead of Professor going to him. But the Blob, knowing the X-Men will be coming for him, returns to the carnival, where he muscles his way into control and builds a Carney army to attack the X-Men proactively. Angel, doing a quick recon mission, flies overhead and gets shot at by the Carnies. Returning to the X-Mansion, the Angel relays the events at the carnival, which confirms Professor Xavier's suspicions. The Professor is working on a mass influencer device to drive the memories of the X-Men out of the minds of many people. Professor X has the X-Men put on alert and ordered to don their uniforms. But it seems that time has run short as a giraffe pokes its head into the window of the X-Mansion, signaling the arrival of the Blob and his Carney army. As the barrage begins, a small group tries to use a battering ram to bash down the door of the mansion, only to find Jean opening it for them, backed up by an optic blast from Cyclops. Tightrope walkers try to enter via the roof, but are not a match for Beast's agility. However, a gorilla is, and while Beast wrestles the simian soldier, the Angel dodges a lasso artist and a human cannonball. The rest of the X-Men try to aid their teammates and get charged at by an elephant, which really doesn't do much as Cyclops blasts it away, proving how much power he actually does have. Iceman is overpowered by a couple of goons in insulated suits, and when Marvel Girl rushes to his aid, she finds herself surrounded. Watching from the X-Mansion, in the nice safe room, the Professor notes that without the use of his legs, he can't aid them in the physical sense, but he can use his brain and finish the device. With all but Cyclops rounded up, it comes down to a well-placed optic blast at the ground beneath the blob to knock the evil mutant off his feet. The small victory is short-lived, and as this distraction is exactly what the pair of goons needed to overtake Psyche and throw a bag over his head. With only helpless Professor X left, the Carnies storm the halls of Xavier's mansion. Knowing what is coming, Professor X sends Marvel Girl a telepathic message. She is not as helpless as she thinks. Using her telekinesis, Marvel Girl is able to untie her blindfold and grab some throwing knives from one of the carnival's wagons, which she uses to cut the bindings off of herself and then her fellow X-Men. This is perfect timing since the Blob and company have reached Professor Xavier's quarters, and before the Carnies can attack, an ice wall forms to block them off from Professor X, and the carpet comes alive, wrapping many of the foot soldiers up. The Blob is taken momentarily out of commission when Cyclops bores a hole in the ground beneath him, and the rest are put into submission by the Beast's fleet feet and Angel's feathery fury, and Cyclops' bountiful optic blasts. This gives the Professor just the advantage he needs to use his mass device and erase the memory of the X-Men from each and every carnival worker's mind, and before we know it, the show is back on at the carnival just as it was when Cyclops first set foot on the soil. With the day saved, we wrap up with this thought. The brain of a mutant is an unpredictable thing. Professor X knows that someday the Blob's memory may return, but when it does, the X-Men will be ready. And this particular story was reprinted in Marvel Superheroes number 22, Amazing Adventures number 5, Amazing Adventures number 6, Marvel Masterworks volume 3, X-Men number 1 through 10 hardcover, Essential Uncanny X-Men volume 1, and then the X-Men Omnibus volume 1.
The Blob has some serious buck teeth on this cover.
Just a little bit. Only if you say serious in the terms of Bugs Bunny.
Teddy Which Roosevelt. Is unfortunate because he's also fat, and that's just not a good combination. Though I do think it's funny that he's got Marvel Girl by the arm, and she's trying like hell to use her telekinesis to push him away.
Not successfully.
No, not at all.
But I mean, if you were going to go after one of them, Jean would probably be the first choice.
We get another really dynamic splash page of apparently a Bale shooting gun, which is kind of cool, really.
A little bit.
I like it. I again, you know, third time in a row where we're opening on something really exciting happening on the right away. But on page two, we really get all the personalities starting to cement. We get a new Beast, basically.
He's now a bookworm.
Little man, did anyone ever tell you that you are a feather-brained fathead?
And see, now, when you do it in that voice, it's completely different than what I read, because I still had the Beast from issues one and two, the sort of, I had a gravelly, more palooka voice.
Little man, did anyone ever tell you that you're a feather-brained fathead?
See, it works both ways.
Yes, it does.
But either way you cut it, Cyclops is so cursed.
As much of a jerk as Professor Xavier has been, it's really funny that he's like, Scott, what's wrong? Why are you glum, chum?
That's a great
Give point. Us a smile.
Come on, buck up, pal.
Sorry, sir. It's just that I worry about the awesome power in my eyes.
And this is the first time we actually hear him called Scott, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, because he was Slim before.
Slim. So Scott's first name makes its first appearance?
At least until John Byrne draws him, and then he's not skinny.
True. He starts getting ripped.
He starts hitting the weights. Some bully beat him up at a diner, and he got sick of it. So he started working out. I mean, Iceman and Angel are pretty much the same, but we definitely have more of a personality. And even though it seems kind of two-dimensional today, again, at the time, this was kind of revolutionary. So to see a hero that, you know, was tortured by his own ability, it was still kind of novel at this point. So I can see where it being kind of an exciting concept.
And a lot of people give Scott a lot of crap for being, well, melodramatic. And admittedly, this does come off as melodramatic, but when you think about what Scott can do, punching holes in mountains, let's be honest, he has a right to be a little bit worried.
On page three, we have a real... Only Jack Kirby could make a scene of a girl levitating a book through a maze, basically, look exciting.
Yeah, it's a maze that reminds me of a comic book rack. I don't think they had those in the 60s, but...
I think they had spinner racks in the 60s.
Okay, they may have. It looks like an Art Deco spinner rack.
Yes. Looks like Andy Warhol's comic book spinner rack.
That's awesome.
Also at the bottom of page three, glowing eyes of doom.
I have the same note. That's just that's even creepier than Professor X looking over the planet Earth.
Yeah. Though it's interesting that he doesn't need Cerebro yet.
Well, he has issues. Cerebro definitely kicks it up a notch.
And on the next page, he's massaging his own head at the very top of it.
I like to rub hot oil. It's VO5. It works on the scalp, too.
And at the bottom, poor Professor X. You know, one day when you and Jean are a little older, you can really tell... What? Yeah.
When Jean is what is known as legal.
The thing is, that line, don't worry, as if I could help worrying about the one I love, but I can never tell her. I have no right, not while I'm the leader of the X-Men and confined to the wheelchair. So right away, we have yet another typical Marvel mismatched romance that thankfully never went anywhere.
It's not still, referenced again in for over 30 years, so...
Because, you know, this one is, she's pretty and young, but he's in a wheelchair, so he thinks she can never love him. But it's just the fact that he's her teacher, and the way he's touching her arm in that previous panel, it's just like, wow. But when he's lighting that pipe, he looks completely disinterested in her. So I'm wondering if that was Kirby's idea when he drew that page and Stan's like, no, this is what I'll do here.
Or maybe it's the professor dealing with his blue balls. I could be wrong.
That's possible.
But, you know, it could be almost. It can, I mean, really, once read, it's pretty clear, but it could almost be read as if maybe it's a fatherly parental love, but
no
right to tell her kind of changes that. Oh, he's a dirty,
don't
dirty
worry.
Man.
Yes. It's just creepy.
Yeah, the more I read these, the more I used to kind of have respect for Professor X, and I don't care if you wrap it up in the awesomeness that is Patrick Stewart. Creepy. Creepy and creepier.
I just hope he hasn't bought those Chuck Berry brand hidden cameras to put in her room.
Oh.
That would just be terrible. Oh, God. But, yeah, Warren Worthington just kind of steals her right away. The arrogant braggart. One of these days he'll go too far.
And then he might lose his wings or something. I don't know. Maybe get metal ones.
At least it's not Fantastic Four when somebody ran out of the room. Reed Richards immediately assumed they were going to turn against the FF and that they might have to stop them.
It's like some weird soap opera. Don't let him drive drunk. What? Don't let him turn on us. I may have to mind wipe them. Oh, I mean...
Hey, Reed, Ben went out to get some donuts. You want some donuts? Donuts? That sounds good. But I hope Ben's not gone long, for if he turns against the Fantastic Four, he's just getting donuts!
Settle it down, Reed!
What's wrong with you? Get that stick out. Page 5, we once again see the Beast walking up the wall, which is interesting.
Well, I like that it's just that small... It shows how dexterous he really is.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a... And I don't know if even a monkey could actually pull that off.
So dexterous that on the next page, he's able to stand against the wall as if he was clinging to it.
Well, almost like a spidery superhero.
But that's just crazy talk.
Those things don't exist. And on that same page, we get that weird sharpshooter incident. These red herrings. The first two were kind of funny. This one's just like, really? And Cyclops, his glasses are not red. I don't think we've even had a mention of ruby quartz yet.
No, I think that is down the line. Though it's nice that Charles Xavier's creepy eyes could join Scott at the carnival at the bottom of page 6.
Hi.
It's almost like the beginning of Scooby-Doo.
That's awesome. Not in a good way. Scooby-Doo was at least amusing. This is just... It looks like he should be in a windowless van with a lot of Milky Way candy bars. And wow. Tylenol PM. What is? Who watches over somebody like that?
Whichever one of you could take the most Tylenol PM wins.
I've been looking for my paper boy. Want some of that good news? But we also get the first appearance of the Blob here, too. We should probably point that out.
The Blob. Sorry, we're too busy making pedophilia jokes. The Blob in the most unassuming first appearance ever.
Do you get the idea that I don't think they intended to reuse him at this point?
No, and yet he is a character that has permeated into not only later eras of this title, but into just about every animated series and even the Wolverine film.
And the video game. The arcade
game. Yes, and it's... really interesting. Who knew that this one had legs? But only as part of a team.
It's funny you should mention that this legs, because I don't know if he can see his.
He can see his big toe. And that's it. It's sad. The Blob is one of those characters I could actually cosplay as. In this outfit, too. All he's wearing is purple shorts, a pink shirt, and Count Dracula's cape from Tomb of Dracula. So... Not Dracula. It looks like
Count Nefaria, but that's down the line.
Yes, way down the line. So, why is Scott joining in on trying to tackle him? It looks really awkward. Like he's not even really trying.
I was gonna say he's not in a position like the others are, where you can actually see some exertion. He's just sort of, let me give you a quick shoulder massage. How's that feel?
He's got a Cheeto stuck in that fat roll.
Oh.
That's great. I'm getting down.
It's ironic because in just several panels later, he has bullets stuck in there.
That is true. And I love the shot of the guy shooting at the blob. It looks like a Western comic.
Yeah.
All the time.
And colored completely red, but predominantly red.
It's just a neat dynamic panel. In the middle. I mean, it's more dynamic than the bullets going off the blob. It really is.
That just looks like a diagram when the bullets bounce off. It's just your bullet here.
Yeah, just like, doo, 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 doo. On the next page, Scott is a little more forceful. They want to see you. I was sent to bring you to their headquarters, and the X-Men don't take no for an answer.
Apparently, Scott's bipolar.
Wouldn't surprise me.
Oh, no. But it's pretty blatant here that I think he tries to be the tough guy, but I don't think he's intimidated anybody yet.
He will someday, just not yet. And Warren and Jean walk in with the look on Warren's face like they no, we totally weren't making out in the car before we came out here. Came in here.
Hold on there. Let go of the lady's arm.
Let me handle this. And then he puts Blob in a really flattering position.
I don't think Blob has flattering positions.
But, you know, once again, we have an early Marvel book where we have a show off, a display of a power, and apparently his power is to put out flaming pieces of wood. So that's very cool. And he smokes cigars throughout this entire thing. And you know they're the cheap cigars, like the cheapest he can find. And he smells like six-day-old cigar smoke and Dunkin' Donuts.
Wow. Why Dunkin' Donuts?
I don't know, because I already made a Krispy Kreme joke, I think, earlier, so I wanted to change things up a little bit. So, cutting down, this whole scene with them fighting the blob is actually pretty interesting, because basically they invited him to into their house, said, hey, join our team. He said no. And Professor Xavier's first reaction is, this is unheard of. No one has ever refused us before. You cannot be permitted to leave now that you know our identities. It's out of the question. What are you going to do, keep the blob in the basement?
That's what I wondered is, what happens to the axe that screw up?
Is there like an acid bath in the cellar? It's like, no, seriously, go take a swim in the pool. It's great.
They make Soylent Green out of him? Oh, they could eat for months.
Or they lobotomize him. It's like all the workers on the grounds of Professor Xavier's mansion are all mentally handicapped people he lobotomized after they learned his identity.
Oh, Javier doesn't know how he got that money.
They do great work, though. And they're doing very well. Angel, at the bottom of page 10, flies up to hit him. This would be a very standard Kirby fight pose of, like, the whole body stretching up as he delivers the blow. That's kind of cool. Captain America would do it a lot.
Yeah.
And more amusingly, in the full page splash where he goes, one of us isn't getting out of this fight, and it one of us is getting out of this fight, and it won't be me.
What?
One of the best misprint in Marvel. No, it was an issue of Captain America where he's fighting a guy, right? And he goes, one of us isn't going to get out of here, or one of us is going to get out of here, and it won't be me.
Nice.
So, but after we get through the whole fight and everything, we get to the panel 3 of page 12 when the blob escapes into the sewers. Swiftly, the uncanny blob makes his way among the vast network of underground cables and circuits which form the heart and nerve center of every major metropolis.
What?
What? Is this just something that Jack thought, well, maybe they'd have circuitry in their sewer system, and Jack and Stan saw that and said, that doesn't make any sense. I'm going to say it's under the city. It's like, no.
I don't know if you know this, but water and electrical components don't go together. And since sewage is meant to wash away water, ergo.
Jumping ahead for me to page 14. I love the fact that Bobby is making a sundae in his room. And then a giraffe pops into the window.
That is some Hunter S. Thompson stuff right there.
It really is. I just want the image. It's like if this was live action, the giraffe would pop in and start eating the ice cream, and the camera would just slowly focus in on Bobby's face as he was staring at the audience with that, huh?
Wah, wah, wah. But the thing is, he doesn't look as surprised. I mean, if you and I saw a giraffe in the window, I think there'd be a lot more surprise than, hey, what's going on?
Yeah.
Willikers.
Suffering snowballs.
Yeah. It's an invasion. I think, and I mean, he does turn around and use a mop on it to stuff it out, but.
You, out! Out! Get, no, bad giraffe! I like the fact that they've taken the time to build scaffolding in the,
And nobody noticed. The professor's telepathic and he doesn't notice these people are on his land?
Yes.
There are gates to the mansion, people.
However, I love page 15 because they're going to ram, and the blob is suddenly bald on that page. It was really bizarre.
Yeah, but I had a note on that.
They have, like, the people ramming the door, but Marvel Girl opens it, and the first thing they're faced with is Cyclops, and he just blows him right back out of the house, and it's just this great scene. I love that.
It's one of my favorite sequences in this issue. Because it's like, comical, but it's also good action.
It's great action because it shows they're ready for him. It's like, no, come on in. Bam. It's just like somebody opening the door and then immediately punching you in the face. So,
I mean, this whole sequence is good. The barrage on the mansion is pretty start to finish, pretty solid.
Mm-hmm. Just absolutely great. And I even love the fact that the Beast gets to fight a giant gorilla that reminds him of his last blind date, apparently. Olga didn't shave either. So, she had a lovely goatee, though.
I mean, I know Hank's odd-looking, but I think he could do better than Olga.
But we have, like, this really great action sequence where the X-Men are defeated, and then Cyclops rallies back, and then Cyclops is defeated. And then really cool scene of Marvel Girl using her telekinesis to take off her blindfold and to get a knife to cut the ropes, which is all, like, well and good. But once again, we're ending an issue with Professor X saving the day by wiping people's minds.
It's becoming a habit now.
I mean, I can legitimately see Stan not remembering what happened at the end of the last issue.
Probably. I mean, he was writing several books at this time, and they probably blur together at some point.
So I'm not faulting him for it. It's just really strange and doesn't cast a very good light on Professor X.
You think?
This is his finishing move.
Finish him. Professor X wins. Flawless victory.
I don't know, but we better return to the carnival before we get sacked.
Well, when you think about this, in 1990, was it 93 or 94 that Fatal Attractions happened?
Mm-hmm.
People went absolutely crazy when Professor X wiped Magneto's mind as if this was unheard of. Professor X is above that. Well, here's your proof. No, he's not. It's a habit.
Oh, it was like a year or so later that Mark Waid was about to take over his very short stint on the X-Books, which is kind of sad because I would have liked to have seen what he would have done more with the characters. But, you know, his first thing was, Professor X is kind of scary. And it actually made Onslaught make sense.
Yeah.
in a very weird way that if he's pulling crap like this, and you know what, it would have been just as easy for the writers of that time period to just kind of write these issues off as, oh, it's just fluffy, it was just starting, this really wasn't the X-Men yet. But to have somebody go back and go, no, there's something intrinsically wrong with Professor Xavier as a human being that he has no compunctions of violating somebody's mind. I mean, really and truly, by removing memories and such, you are, on a very base level, removing a section of a person's life. And that's a violation on the highest order. But he keeps freaking doing it, and the X-Men are just smiling at the end. Well, except Scott. Scott's got the grimace on the bottom of the last page, but Angel's smiling. Beast is kind of sticking his head in the panel, looking like Bill Dautry from King of the Hill. Howdy, Hank! Marvel Girl's got this creepy smile, like she's wondering which one she's going to date that night. And date is in quotes there.
Wink!
Just to tell you. Xavier's got like almost this creepy smile on his face.
It's more than a little scary. I don't even think scary covers it.
No, I mean, this was a good issue.
Oh, go ahead.
I was about to say, this was a good issue. Don't get me wrong. I mean, to introduce a character, have them invite him onto the team, and then he turns him down so that then he becomes an enemy, that's a great plot. It's just there's these little specific moments in this issue that make me really uncomfortable.
Well, you mean like Professor X happening to concoct a machine to hit a bunch of people, his mass influencer?
Yeah, or him being really into a 16-year-old girl, which, by the way, would not be pedophilia. It would be pederasty, which is a different concept altogether, but they both get kind of blurred together. I'm not going to go into that because it's going to make me seem like I'm really creepy. I just watch a lot of Law & Order Special Victims Unit. So. But, yeah, just... It's becoming a habit with these X-Men issues that I really, really like them and yet find several faults with them, some major, some minor, in this issue rather major.
Well, not just Professor X, you know, having the hots for Jean, because I don't entirely judge that. He never acted upon it. He just considers her attractive. I can live with that to some extent. Except for the fact that they're living in the same house, but, you know. What made him think the Blob would be a good addition to the X-Men?
Well, he's a mutant.
Is that the only requirement?
Apparently.
Because I think the requirements become more stringent down the road.
There wasn't an interview process where it's like, come on in, let's have a, you know, I'm not getting a good vibe off this guy, Professor. I think we should leave him at the coffee shop.
leave him with his Annie DeFranco CDs and
wow, Annie DeFranco, very nice.
I have moments. Let him eat his jicama all alone. But I think it's funny that the battle that ensues in the mansion is pretty comical when he refuses to join them because it's grab him, and the Beast actually, instead of stopping him, manages to let him out the door. This is supposed to be the smart one.
He has his moments. I mean,
and they have to carry him back in. It's so pathetic.
But he is very smart. He's talking like he's talking with highfalutin 25-cent words now. So
reading calculus books. But yeah, I didn't.
So, and I like that concept for the Beast, though. I like the big lumbering guy who's really freaking smart.
It works out really well all the way through the characters. Well, there are some moments in the 80s that there were some problems, but that's
yeah, because he lost his intelligence during Exeter at one point.
Yeah.
Which is kind of interesting. But no, it's just, and it's why Kelsey Grammer playing the character was so spot on.
Two of the best casting choices ever. Kelsey Grammer as Beast and Patrick Stewart as Professor X.
Mm-hmm. Though I thought James Marsden made a very good Cyclops. Yeah. They just gave him absolutely nothing to do with being Cyclops. He looked like the character, especially when he put those shades on. It's just, you know, But just Kelsey Grammer in general uplifted that film to me. It's why I enjoy that film more than a lot of people do. It's because I just love watching his performance because he's in the moment. He's not thinking this is silly. He's in the makeup, and he's just going for it. And I love the concept. By the time this episode airs, we'll probably have seen the film by then. I like the concept that we're going back to see his roots with the X-Men and how he got that outfit that didn't fit quite so well.
That's awesome. But that's all my notes for this issue. I thought it was okay. I thought the carnival attack was phenomenal.
Oh, yeah, just about everything about it. I mean, it was goofy. Don't get me wrong. I mean, I'm not going to sit here and go, well, this is the most serious comic ever written. But at the same time, it was enjoyable. It's what a comic book should be. It's fun. And, you know, I can read a comic for a deep and meaningful story, but sometimes I just want to sit back and watch a giraffe eat an ice cream cone. Not that I ever thought of seeing such a thing would amuse me until I saw this issue, but yeah, it's funny as hell.
Yeah, I kind of love that sequence. Hey! So what did you think of this month's ads?
Well, we got an all-transistor rich wristwatch-type radio straight out of Dick Tracy comic strips. That's kind of interesting.
Why do I not, in the 21st century, have a Dick Tracy-style wrist-mounted cell phone?
It's coming, trust me. Though I do like the fact that this is the first transistor radio nano.
Yeah,
I'm glad that Neuresk Industries in Chicago decided that was a void that needed filling. draw any person in 1 minute, no talent and no lessons. So obviously some of the 90s image artists saw this ad and became...
Zing! We're looking at you, Rob Liefeld.
I actually rather like Rob Liefeld, but that's...
How many characters? How many of his characters have feet?
None, but I still like the guy's art for some reason. I don't think it's good, but I like it.
Okay, fair enough.
Yeah. You'll have fun and thrills with this 7-foot giant kite. And I had to make sure I pronounced the T on that word very carefully.
Yes.
Proving that they will sell you anything in a comic book.
7-foot kite. That's bigger than... I'm at 5'8". That thing's bigger than me.
Yeah, I'm 5'5". How do you think I feel? That thing's a foot and a half taller than I am.
Well, it's a hang glider. That's not a kite.
You're absolutely right, actually, especially to a child. It wasn't even scary. Just picture this children out in the field trapped under the kite trying to fight for freedom.
I'm sure somebody tried to take that off of a bluff. I hate to admit it, but I would have.
And the 6 months of recovery and learning how to walk and feed yourself again would have been worth it.
Totally. For that 30 seconds of flight that just happened to be pointed straight down.
We've got the treasure chest of fun with another miniature radio, jujitsu,
some sort of Starfleet branded radio.
It's kind of cool. Got a bike windshield that looks like it's halfway to that Captain America motorcycle from the 1970s pilot film.
Thank you, Reb Brown.
Atomic smoke bomb.
There you go.
Great, you could order dirty bombs. Perfect.
Only in the 60s.
We have the Hypno Coin. And a reward, $11,750 for this coin. So... I never got into collecting coins. So.
I never saw the point, I won't lie.
I don't judge it. I don't judge most hobbies, except maybe, you know, like... Well, even I don't judge furries. I mean, whatever makes you feel good. And some of those women are kind of hot, so...
They're not hurting anybody.
Yeah.
Come on, fella. Grab this chance to make $1 to $5 weekly.
for grit, because you can 102 smash songs that I can't read to say an unforgettable. Okay, Johnny Angel, Sherry, The Peppermint Twist.
Wow.
Mr. Bassman. Hey, Mr. Bassman, you got that special something. Reminds me of the Muppets.
That's awesome. Holy Gully, baby. What? Mashed potato time.
Mashed potato was a dance, as I learned from my mother when I was a teenager. We were listening to the oldies station. Georgia on My Mind. God, that song goes back far. Daddy's Home, Some Kind of Wonderful. It's almost like looking at the sailboat. If you stare at the list long enough, song titles appear.
Yeah, but
Zippity Doodah.
Do you notice that none of the artists are listed?
No.
That's probably one of those crappy remakes that you find, oh, it has all these soundtrack songs that I like, and then you realize it's by some symphony that's in junior college somewhere in
Starlight
Ohio.
Starlight Singers.
Yes. This isn't Celine Dion.
This is somebody even whiter. My God. How could such a thing happen?
Stella, look what has happened.
Another jumbled bag of horrible, horrible ways of stealing money from children. Smashing Collection Free includes Triangles, Early United States, Rockets, Sports. What the heck are they advertising here?
Poems Wanted?
Poems Wanted, just set to music. Please send us your lyrics that we will set to music and then promptly not pay you.
Yeah.
And thus, Bono gets his first song.
Hey.
Oh, I didn't realize you were a fan of U2. Actually, I have nothing against Bono, so.
Now you're backpedaling.
Yes, I am. Well, no, seriously, I don't. I just really wish you would stay out of World Affairs.
Well, okay, fair enough.
Just keep writing songs. I have nothing against him musically. I just wish he would shut up.
Actually, the funny thing is you can actually Google. If you Google a search, U2 Kansas City 2001, you'll actually find a picture of the back of my head and Bono. Because I was crowd control at that concert.
Very cool. Another amateur magic ad with a picture of a guy that looks like he's checking out the floating woman's behind.
Who seems to be nude. What kind of ad is this? And maybe that's just my mind, but I completely missed that it's an amateur magic ad. I just saw a woman with a sheet draped over her.
That's creepy.
And then that guy. Hey.
Hey, boys, men, he's Mike Marvel. My secret new Dynaflex method can build you a magnificent new He-Man muscled body in just 10 minutes a day with absolutely no weights, no barbells, and no exercise at all. And that's when you know that he's lying.
You know what's awesome is that free, he adds, the secrets of being attractive. What is he, Link Thompson? I'm a handsome man.
Mail the coupon now and receive Mike Marvel's free gift to you. This exciting, informative book. Discover a new secret method for developing a new, almost magnetic way of being attractive and popular. At parties, dances, at the beach, you will have the people clustering around you breathlessly while the guys watch enviously. What does he have that we don't? Apparently anabolic steroids.
It's a gasser.
That's kind of sad. Learn radio, television, electronics. Again, hippie, get a job. It's more NRI trained men.
Nobody built a missile this time around. I'm kind of disappointed.
After graduating, I was a shipboard radio operator. That's great. We've got a better look at the creepy guy for the hypnotizing.
And the clarity makes him that much creepier.
Though the picture is worse, and it looks like the guy's really trying to grab the woman's breasts this time. And he looks sleazy enough that he did slip her the roofie. Wow. And that's the back cover.
And she looks kind of drowsy, so I'm starting to believe it. I believe.
Oh, man. What a wacky, wacky issue.
Well, elsewhere in the world of Marvel, in the Marvel saga this month, Giant Man has a showdown with the Human Top in Tales to Astonish number 51. Spider-Man takes on the Living Brain and the Human Torch in Amazing Spider-Man number 8. And once again, the Human Torch returns to take on the Thing by way of the Puppet Master in Strange Tales number 116. The Mole Man returns to menace the Marvel Universe in Fantastic Four number 22. And an Avenger turns on his team as the Hulk's tenure ends, and the team takes on the Submariner in Avengers number 3. Such a storied career with the Avengers. And Thor takes on Mr. Hyde in Journey into Mystery number 100, which brings us to Tales of Suspense number 49. And this, ladies and gentlemen, is the first time any of the X-Men have crossed over into the main Marvel Universe. And the long story, to put it in a quick reference guide for you, to give you an idea of what this issue is, essentially, Tony Stark is doing tests in the desert, which Angel somehow manages to kind of finagle his way into, and before Tony Stark can warn him, he gets hit by a blast, which pretty much turns him evil for most of the issue. He returns to the X mansion and basically ignores Professor X's mental command return and tells him he's going to go join the evil mutants because that's where the action is. As Professor X attempts to use his top secret communication device, he gets a hold of the Avengers. Well, he tries to get a hold of the Avengers, but none of the Avengers are there. Now keep in mind at this time, it's Hulk, Thor, Giant Man, Wasp, and Iron Man, which Tony happens to be there, and he kind of feels kind of responsible for Angel's madness since he couldn't warn him, so he decides to make the boy come back to his senses. So Angel flies around New York City being all evil, and Iron Man pursues him, and basically the two fight. Iron Man knocks some sense into him, and Angel explains that, hey, I was affected by the radiation from the atomic explosion. And all the X-Men arrive on the scene and thank Iron Man for bringing their teammate back. But that is the first crossover.
I feel different, as though I'm a new person. A smarter, craftier, slyer person. And yes, I admit it, a far more evil person. That's actually kind of cool. This story proves a point. And that point is Steve Ditko should stick to drawing Spider-Man and Doctor Strange.
Easy.
And leave the rest of the Marvel Universe alone.
I'll give you that. His Iron Man's really awkward. I like it for a weird reason that it reminds... Well, Angel's wings are awkward too, but it reminds me of Mike Allred.
A little bit, which really doesn't sell me on it, but no, it's nothing against Steve Ditko. I'm not insulting him because I do not want to get a 30-page, single-spaced, double-sided diatribe on why I'm wrong. But I think Ditko serves very well with certain types of characters. Iron Man is not one of them. Because Iron Man, you want power. Ditko is not power. He is mood. And I'm not trying to make it seem like he can only do one thing, but the reason why his Spider-Man and his Doctor Strange work so well is because his art style was geared towards that. He's a very dynamic artist. I mean, those early issues of Spider-Man are great. The action scenes are wonderful. But when I think of Iron Man, I think of a dude in a big metal suit.
Yeah.
You know, and we've seen the Angel drawn by no one for three issues but Jack Kirby, and here he's really skinny and kind of scrawny. So that's my only thing. I didn't realize you were such a Ditko fan. I do apologize.
Me? No.
Oh, you said watch it. Like, I just...
I was expecting that 30-page double-sided.
Oh, okay. But, he's just not suited for Iron Man. He's definitely not suited for the Incredible Hulk.
No.
And I'll fight every man who says what he is. What is. I mean, seriously.
Well, it's not that he has a bad style. It's just certain artists do better with other characters. Spider-Man is this sleek character, and it worked really well. Iron Man is you mentioned it. He's in this armor. He's got some bulk to him and some heft. And that doesn't necessarily fit Ditko's style.
I do like the fact that we get to see what all the other characters in the Marvel Universe are doing, and it takes like less than a half a page. It's like Bruce Banner looking like Tom Kalmaku from the Green Lantern series over at DC. Far to the west, in a New Mexico proving ground, Bruce Banner is at work in a lab, which means there is no Hulk at the moment to receive the X-Men's message. While Mighty Thor, in his other identity as Dr. Don Blake, is making his rounds at Municipal Hospital. And Giant Man and the Wonderful Wasp are speaking of guys that picked up girls that were underage. And Giant Man and the Wonderful Wasp are enjoying a rare social evening together as Henry Penn and Janet Van Dyne and only have eyes and thoughts for each other. Because she was like a teenager when her dad died, and she basically moved in with him.
Well, let's be honest. So, Hank Pym is probably not the role model for anybody. I like to slap Janet around when nobody's looking.
He did it once. He hit her once.
But what a hit it was.
It's a hit so much that he's considered a wife beater. And I'm not endorsing what happened. I'm not saying Janet had it coming. So,
but I want a t-shirt that says that now.
What, Janet had it coming?
Yeah.
That'll get letters. I think, in all honesty, in modern audiences, it was Mark Miller's version of Hank Pym and the Ultimates that ultimately, no pun intended, did more damage to that character as an abuser.
Or it could be the fact that he created Ultron, and he's not mentally there.
No, but to hang that on him, and it's an argument that the guys over at Clone Saga Chronicles and ASM Classics have made countless times, you have to lump Peter Parker into that category as well. Because not only did he slap Mary Jane, he slapped Mary Jane when she was pregnant. I mean, that's like the plot to half of Lifetime's movies.
Melissa Gilbert is Mary Jane Watson.
That might have actually worked at one point, in all honesty.
At one time, yeah.
So, but I will admit I didn't fully read this story because I forgot what issue you had told me until tonight. So, but it looks like something I would want to go and check out at a later date. Just to see what it's all about, because you know, maybe if I ever go through going through the early Iron Man stuff, past what I had read and had to stop at. Though, was this in that Masterworks?
I don't. Let me check real quick. Thanks to Mike's Amazing World of DC Comics, we know almost everything about every issue ever published
of anything.
Yeah. Let's see. No, this one wasn't reprinted until Giant Size Iron Man number one.
Okay.
Oh, man, so that's a much better cover, too.
But it was worth mentioning, to at the very least, to show us where else the X-Men were at this time.
It's weird that they had a crossover that early in the print run.
Mm-hmm.
Primarily because when you think about the X-Men, they're kind of a universe amongst themselves.
Yes.
And, I mean, they do obviously exist in the Marvel Universe. They cross over. But primarily, they stick into their own little corner there. Because when I was a teenager, it was the Marvel Universe and then the X-Men Universe. But they were. They were their own franchise. Occasionally, Spider-Man might pop up here and there. But generally, you could follow along, and it's pretty insular.
Yeah, I could see that. I mean, it got a little wonky in the 80s because everything kind of crossed over into each other in the 80s, at least by mention. So, but, it's kind of funny that Stan would so many times use his books to kind of advertise other books and to show what all the other characters were doing. It created a tight sense of continuity, but at the same time, it also created a cliche almost.
So. Yeah. But this would be a little piece of X-Men history. And speaking of history, as far as the real world, November 1963, when this book would have been on stands, we saw on November 2nd, 1963, South Vietnamese President Ngo Dinh Diem was assassinated following a military coup, which would play into the Vietnam War. On November 6th, the coup leader, General Duong Van Minh, takes over as leader of the South Vietnam. Ironically, on the same day, Laura Welch caused a car accident that would result in the death of Michael Dutton Douglas in Midland, Texas. Why is that important? Laura Welch would be one day become Laura Bush, First Lady of the United States. Anything can happen in America, kids.
That's right. No, I'm not going to do the quote. I'm sorry.
No, it's a matter of fucking... On November 10th, Malcolm X makes his historic Message to the Grassroots speech in Detroit, Michigan, which is interesting to see the civil rights movement take that other turn. On November 18th, the first push-button telephone is made available to AT&T customers. Keep in mind, at this time, they actually had to come in and wire the phone into the wall. It was an installation, which continued actually up until I was a little kid. I know, so probably you too.
Yeah, I think so.
And on November 22nd, 1963, the Beatles' second UK album, With the Beatles, is released, which is awkward timing, because that is the day John F. Kennedy was assassinated in Dallas, Texas, which would, of course, pave the way for Lyndon B. Johnson to become president and many, many years of conspiracy theories.
And November 22nd, 1963, JFK is assassinated in Texas. 30 years later, I would start dating a girl during my senior year. It lasted 2 years and ended about as badly. So,
was it back and to the left?
It was back and to the left as her hand reached into my chest, went back and to the left and ripped my heart out.
I gave her my heart and she gave me a pen. On November 23rd, the first episode of Doctor Who was broadcast in the United Kingdom, which would go on to be, it still runs today. And November 24th, Lee Harvey Oswald, the alleged assassin of John F. Kennedy, was shot dead by Jack Ruby in Dallas, shutting him up once and for all. Meanwhile, a tribute to John F. Kennedy from the arts, featuring actors, opera singers, noted writers, all performing dramatic readings and or music, was telecast on ABC TV. On November 25th, U.S. President Kennedy was buried at Arlington National Cemetery. Schools around the nation do not have class that day. Millions watched the funeral on live international television. And on November 29th, Lyndon B. Johnson establishes the Warren Commission to investigate the assassination of President Kennedy. So this was a big month in terms of history.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. You don't get much bigger than that, especially in the 60s in the United States. I mean, you really wouldn't even start touching that until 68.
No. But it's weird
in all
that
honesty.
This previous issue, they talked about the chief executive, and then you... Do you think it's because he knew about mutants?
Yes.
Do you think the magic bullet was Magneto? I don't know. I don't know if that's something that's inappropriate to joke about, so I'm going to shy away.
Well, it's not like we knew the man. I mean, it's not like it's, you know, September 12th, 2001, and we're making 9/11 jokes. So.
True. But that...
it happened, it's coming up on like 50 years ago.
True.
So.
Wow. But that wraps up our show, unless you have anything else.
No, like I said, liked the issue. Wish I would have read more of that Tales of Suspense issue, but it's kind of cool that they were thinking of the X-Men as a successful property this so early on that they started guesting them in other titles.
And I do want to, speaking of that, I do want to give a special thanks to John M. Wilson, because he pointed out that particular crossover. I almost missed it. So thank you, John. You've been a great help and a great support to this show.
Yes, sir. John's a great guy.
Yep. We like John. We will see you next time around when we continue this mutant journey.
In more ways than one.
Wink. Thanks, guys.
Bye, everybody.
You can find Xavier's Podcast for Gifted Youngsters on iTunes and at xavierspodcast.com. To get in touch with the show, you can drop us an email. The address is xavierspodcast@gmail.com. And you can become a fan of the show on Facebook at facebook.com/Xavier's Podcast. Until next time, thank you for listening.
Yes, the X-Men have won, but only for now. Magneto is still out there, waiting, planning, plotting the destruction of the human race. But whatever the challenge, whatever the peril, the X-Men will be there.